Save big money right now at Menards. From smoke and carbon monoxide detectors to fire extinguishers and more, Kit of Home Safety products keep your family protected in case of emergencies. Smoke and carbon monoxide detectors are perfect for your living spaces, offering protection and peace of mind. Save big money on all Kit of products at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hi, everybody. Thanks, as always, to our supporters on Patreon, who help to keep this show available as a public resource for those affected by cultic abuse. Thanks also to the few organizations who have stepped up to sponsor the show, and one of those organizations we are proud to be working with is the DeCult Conference happening soon in New Zealand. Today's guest is actually a featured lecturer at the event founded by Anke Richter, who you heard from as a guest here a few months back. Here is Anke again to tell you a bit more about the event.
Kia ora, I'm Anke Richter, who wrote the bestseller Cult Trip, and I'm bringing you an exciting event. Get ready for DeCult 2024, the first cult awareness conference in New Zealand, happening in Christchurch this October. Are you worried about a friend or family member who's in a group that may be causing them harm? Or do you have your own story? Then join us for a weekend with experts from around the world, where those who've left cultic groups can share their experiences and meet professionals who can help them. Head to our website, decult.net, for all the info.
Thanks again to Anke and to DeCult for their support. If you are part of an organization that might be interested in sponsoring the show, please reach out to us at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com for more information. And now on to today's episode. And today I am so happy to introduce a friend and colleague, Dr. Jilly Jenkinson. She is a UK-accredited psychotherapist specializing in cult studies, and she completed both her master's and doctoral research on the recovery process of former cult members, asking the crucial question, what helped you recover from an abusive cult experience? In 2023, Rutledge published her book, Walking Free from the Trauma of Coercive, Cultic, and Spiritual Abuse, a workbook for recovery and growth. I have it. It's great. This work is based on her extensive research and nearly three decades of experience working with first, second, and multi-generational former cult members. Dr. Jenkinson's insights are further informed by her own past experience as a cult member, which you'll hear a little bit about. It's very moving. She is a sought-after keynote speaker and will be a featured lecturer at the upcoming DeCult Conference in New Zealand. For information about Dr. Jenkinson's work, visit her website at www.hopevalleycounseling.com. And for more information about the DeCult Conference, go to www.decult.net. Here is Jilly now. Sometimes when I have a guest on the show, I am really looking forward to hearing their story. And as I am excited to talk to Jilly today about her story, but I was also really excited to see an old friend, someone who I'd hung out with years ago, and we had a lot of laughs and a really good time. And I've missed that, and I haven't been able to attend conferences in some of the places that have been quite far away for me. And so I've missed seeing you. I was really looking forward to talking to you today. Hi, Jilly.
Hi, Rachel. Me too. Really looking forward to it.
So there's so much to talk about, and your fantastic book, which I've purchased, which is just this wonderful guide and really fantastic. And also, I want to start by congratulating you on your award. And so I know that's not something you would necessarily mention. So I wanted to make sure to mention it because I know you're not a flashy person, but it really is a wonderful award. And so if you can talk a little bit about that and how many years of devotion you've had to this cause.
Well, I mean, I'm quite old now, so people who are listening and haven't seen a video of me won't know that. But so the cause has been a very, very long time, you know, 40 years or whatever. And the award, you know, I never really won awards until the last 2 years. So, you know, I was asked, would you like this award? I'm like, yeah, give it to me now. Because I never had an award before. So the acknowledgement of it is really touching and really sort of confirming and affirming. And, you know, you work hard, don't you? And you put stuff out there and you don't know how it's going to be received. And you hope to goodness that it's going to be helpful, but you don't know. So to actually have colleagues on the Diane Cassoni Award is the one you're referring to, which I received in Barcelona, the International Cultic Studies Association conference is where they gave it to me. And actually, I said in my little speech that Diane Cassoni was my external examiner for my PhD.
Oh.
It kind of meant even more to me to get this award because she died really young and she was a forensic psychologist and very active in the field from a very, you know, very academic, very important work in Montreal, Canada. So, yeah. Just, I could barely speak at first. I was sort of like, oh, really choked up and very touched.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, she was taken from us too soon. And I didn't realize the connection. Oh, I don't know how you made it through your speech at all. It would have been very hard.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
And I met her at a couple of the conferences, and she was always, I think, always kind of sharp and very beautiful lady as well.
There are so many people I've come across in this field who I become so enamored with and have so much respect for. I think because they and because we have been involved in something where it was like pushing a boulder uphill and still can feel that way, even with how much the world has started to understand and care and see it as a real thing and how much law is starting to get there and starting to try to understand, and that there are a lot of people now feeling brave enough, I think, because they're now in good company to come out with their stories and do their documentaries. And it's lovely. And for many years, it was not that way. And there was a pushback from a lot of groups and harassment from a lot of groups, along with people saying, is this really a thing? I just don't know. I don't think it would really affect me. And no one I know has been involved in anything like that, which is so interesting because now, I don't know if you've had this experience of just speaking about what you do in any kind of forum, inevitably, at least more than one person says, oh, I was involved in this, or I know someone. And so before, oh, no one knew anyone, but it's the same thing. So I think people just now realize what that thing is called that took over their life or took over their friends or their colleagues or their family members' life, or what that relationship can be seen as, right? And now they have this conceptualization where they realize how much it is woven in to the world that we live in.
Yes, I mean, I agree. When I was doing my doctoral research, I'd tell people I'm doing this research, and then they'd say, what are you doing it in? And I was like, I'm going to have the C word conversation. And then, as you say, often someone would say, well, I nearly joined a cult and my parents got me back from whatever country it was, or yeah, my cousin was in a cult, or I had a boyfriend who joined a cult, or was in a coercive control domestic abuse relationship. And I think probably the documentaries have made a big difference, haven't they? The words around more.
Yeah, right. And I think also the documentaries have been really helpful, I think, in having people see that this comes in different forms and that it really is about the nature of the control. And it can be in a TikTok dance cult, and it can be in a large group awareness training or Synanon or Rajneesh or whatever, and more documentaries along the way, or Nexium and Twin Flames. And I mean, it just is really important, I think, for people so they don't feel persuaded to trust something just because people are not wearing orange robes. You know, it's not about the trappings, you know? So I would love for people to learn about you and sort of what developed your interest in this. And then I want to make sure also we have a chance to talk about your book and where to find it, and because it is just incredibly practical and useful and information rich, which I love. So let's go back to what caused your interest in this.
Well, I was in a cult back in the 70s, and it was a Bible-based group. I became a born-again Christian, and within about a year, like, long story short, I ended up joining a community, so, or a group that became a community very quickly after I joined, so, which means that we just lived in a street in England, but we had different households, and the members of the group then became joined the different households. And I was there for 7 years. It was highly abusive. It was a full-blown thought reform environment. I completely lost myself. I was, to a large degree, cut off from my family, not 100%. And also, it was somewhat less controlling at the beginning, then it evolved to become incredibly 100% controlling. Really, I never thought about leaving. I never had doubts about it. I wasn't able to engage my brain with it. I just kind of was in a sleepwalking through it. And there were physical beatings. It was a terrible place to be. I think you said in one of your other podcasts, or someone said, sometimes actually it's easier if there's the physical abuse because there's something to show for it. But then the psychological abuse actually is what did its work on me. It wasn't abuse, it was the psychological abuse, the thought reform or mind control, as some people call it, and the whole system of control that was there that I've tried to sort of put together in my book to explain what I learned and what I've learned through lots of different means. I met my husband Tony in the last 2 years of the cult. I was there 7 years, and it started to lose its hold somewhat in the last year. And I actually went to visit my father, who lived in Belize at that time. But I wrote a letter to the cult, and then I had a letter back from the leader, really sternly rebuking me, which was a word much, it's loaded language in my group, rebuking me for betraying my household because I wanted to move to a different one, which was just like a teeny chink of something of myself. Of actually, it might be fun. You know, I wasn't asking to leave. And I didn't show my father, unfortunately, and I went back. But within a year, and this was sort of 1981, the cult actually disbanded. So for some reason, the leader's control started to wane. And he had a lot of women in his house who were sexually abused by him. And they started to realize this wasn't a Christian way of being, you know, was giving the Christian language, you know, the words, but he was acting it. They were belly dancing and he, you know, there was all sorts of weird stuff going on in his household. I wasn't in his household. And there was a real kind of system there. So my, or a hierarchy is probably what I mean, is that my household was the bottom of the pile. Like we were the stupid ones who never got anything right. His household apparently did. But then when you talk to those who left that household, they were absolutely terrified and devastated by the whole experience. So Tony and I left in 1980. I think it was around November 1980. The whole thing started to crumble and the leader was challenged by the women in his household. And by 1981, I'd left. And that's a long story short. And Tony and I got married because we didn't have anywhere to go, really. We were adults. We were in our late 20s. We'd left home. So it seemed practical, really, just to get married. But we carried on going to church. So we went to a church who said to us, we know what a cult is. And we were saying the word cult, but we had no idea what we were talking about. I could have said to you I was in a cult, but I really didn't get what that meant. And nobody around us did. And so we had another 14 years living, not in a cult, but in the cult mindset. The cult was still in our heads. We hadn't understood it. We hadn't unpacked it. And then we left. We joined a church near where we live now, which is in sort of middle north of England, and that started to go off the rails, kind of becoming controlling and triggering me off so much, and I felt like I was losing my mind. And I was still stuck in this cult mindset. I couldn't stand up for myself. And then eventually we did, both of us, we just went, that's it. Actually, if we go to hell, we go to hell, but that's it, we're out. And the leader's wife came to see me and said, Jilly, the devil's finally got you. And I thought, you know, I've had enough of this. You know, I thought this shit is just ludicrous. And so we left. And we had some exit counseling from somebody here in the UK. And I tried to find, so they weren't a trained counsellor. I tried to find a trained counsellor. There wasn't anybody then. There was nobody the trained counsellor who understood. And that was my decision point, really, for why I've ended up where I am, which was, I think I'm going to train as a counsellor and I'm going to work with former cult members. And that's 1995, nearly 30 years ago.
You mentioned not being able to speak up for yourself. What were some of the other things you noticed that were the holdovers from having been in it?
I mean, not speaking up for myself, believing I was toxic. I've spoken about this elsewhere. You know, this feeling that of constantly being told that you're a sinner, that you're evil. And some groups, and ours included, would talk about demons. So they'd say, you know, you had a demon in you and they'd want to exorcise the demon. So the end result is just feeling, actually, I'm harmful. I am harmful. And actually, if I say anything, or what is it that I'm going to do that might harm people? And it's not logical, because it is logical because you've been told, but actually, I wasn't doing anything that was harming people. I wasn't toxic. I wasn't harming people. I wasn't shouting or doing things to people. I was just probably quite timid, I think. So that it went on for a long time. I mean, it's a long time. And I would tell people I was stupid. And it was really Tony's kindness, kind of, you know, just like, this is confession, by the way, in thought reform terms. It was like in the cult, we would confess our sins how stupid we were, blah, blah, blah. And so this sort of almost a compulsion to confess, to almost warn people, oh, I'm stupid and, you know, be careful with me, you know, because something might happen. It's kind of magical thinking, really. But it took a long time to undo that habit and to gain confidence, actually. I didn't have any confidence. And actually, the church that we left, where we live now, that was the final church we attended. I actually just had to leave in the end because it was sending me crazy, actually. And they didn't understand and they didn't have compassion. I know what I was going to say. And they actually would tell me off for not having confidence. And that's just probably not fully a cult, really. It's more of a spiritually abusive church on a sort of continuum. You think, well, that's a great way to give people confidence. You're not confident enough, so I'm going to tell you off. Yeah, well, if you want to keep me down, just keep doing it because, yeah. You know, it's working.
Wow, that's so contrary. It's so counterproductive. The clients I work with and the support group that I do, I hear a lot of people make statements that feel absolute at the time, right? Like, I am this. I am of no value. I am stupid. I am difficult. A lot of women will often say, I am difficult. I am a troublemaker. I am manipulative. I'm an angry person, whatever else. They often think they're shouting when they're not. And most of the people in the group or my clients will apologize for talking too long when they just started. And so I will sometimes write down these absolute statements and being sure of these things about yourself, and then we'll come back to them. And I'll say, where did this idea come from? Well, what do you mean? It's who I am and it's what's true about me. No. Let's look at where it came. Did you have it before or do other people see you that way? No. But those get embedded and they become part of your persona. And it's such a hard thing to get rid of. And it sounds like with Tony, who really helped you see you and your value and your abilities, but that it takes that kind of gentleness and probably a lot of repetition.
A lot. Yeah. A lot. And I think as a therapist, we can do that if we see our clients for long enough. But yes, recognizing it helps. And I proved I wasn't stupid because I ended up doing a PhD, but I never thought I could. I mean, you know, and I often say, you know, don't assume you can't do things because, you know, just because I got that, I worked very hard for it. And I was determined, and that's how I got it. It's not because I'm super clever or something. I think people can do a lot more than they think often.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think you are quite clever. But at the same time, I hear your point about just having the confidence.
Yeah, right? But I didn't think I was. I really, really had no idea that this was in me. Even before I joined, I wasn't thinking about that. I was 18 before, you know, as I became a Christian and about 21 when I joined the cult, what became a cult. I didn't actually join a cult. I joined something that became a cult.
Okay. So, yes. So you were following this trajectory of these 14 years and being involved in this church that sounds like it was sort of poured salt in a wound that you already had. And that's really unfortunate.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. So then what happened next?
So we left that church and I got a dog, actually. That was great because we live in a really beautiful area. On my website, there are photographs and it is of this area, all of them. And so I was hiking and then my doctor asked me if I would come and see her. She realized I was depressed. I was discombobulated, and it's like, oh. So it was a while back, you know, and the doctor lived in the village. It was sort of the traditional English village doctor, really. I went to see her and I said, I want to be a counsellor. I'd done some counselling in the church before we left, and it wasn't appreciated. And they wouldn't let me have supervision, which we have to have in the UK. And they wouldn't let me train. So, look, control, control, you know. And so she said, yeah, you should become a counsellor if that's what you feel you want to be. And I said, well, aren't I too messed up to become a counsellor, because I don't feel very sane right now? And she said, yeah. And she said, you do the training, you get the therapy, and you work it out. So I did a diploma in pastoral counselling, because I'd kind of stepped out of the church. Again, the church hadn't stepped out of me, and certainly the cult aspects of church. Although the tutors on the diploma were wonderful. They were sane and what I think a Christian should be, not like certainly the leadership of this group. Wonderful people in the cult, actually, and in this other church. But really, you know, as you said earlier, the leadership then is the one that's sort of driving it in the wrong direction. And I did a diploma in pastoral counselling because I'd missed my 20s and my studying years. So they made me do the first year without letting me go on to the rest of the diploma. And then I did really well. So that was such a confidence boost. Then they said sorry and they let me complete it. Then I practiced for a bit. I went to Wellspring Retreat Centre at the end of that four-year diploma, and I did a four-week internship at Wellspring. And that was where I learned the base of the thought reform model and kind of just the whole setup there. Then I did a master's in Gestalt psychotherapy, which has really served me well in terms of some of the theories in the book and that I use with clients. And then I did the PhD, and I just knew I had to do it. I just wanted, and maybe it was partly around the confidence thing, but I felt, you know, maybe I'd have a bit more of a voice for me if I actually achieved the PhD. And that's definitely been the case. And maybe, as I say, partly to do with my confidence increasing. And I did the work. I mean, I interviewed ex-members, and it's 4 years, 120,000 words dissertation. You know, it's a book in itself. I didn't publish it, but I used it as a base for a lot of the ideas in the book. So that's what kind of brings me to today. And then there's a word I love, which is generative, and it's a sort of stage of life word. And I'm at a stage where it's important to pass things on. Like you do this with your podcast and with, you know, and I decided to do it by training therapists. So I have done two certificates in post-cult counselling in the UK. There's one person from America did it, one from Australia, in the second cohort. And then it's kind of built momentum, and I'm going to do another one next year. And I'm changing the name to the Certificate in the Walking Free Model, Counselling Coercive Cultic and Spiritual Abuse. So it ties in with Walking Free, the book.
Nice. It's lovely.
And then there's New Zealand. Wow. And decult.
Yeah, it's not something I'm going to be able to attend this time around. It's too much happening in my life at the moment that keeps me here. But I hope to be able to be involved in that conference in future years. And it's very important that things are happening in parts of the world where there really has not been any kind of resource. And not only is it important, I think, to have a resource, but people then, I think, feel hopeful that at least there's someone nearby who understands and cares enough about what they've gone through to be able to put together a conference, to be able to talk about it. Yeah, it's very, very important.
Oh, I mean, I think they'll do another one probably in a couple of years and other people will go forward with it. And I'm very honored to be going the first year. And I made a decision very early on when Anke Richter approached me about if I'd verify them, and I did send a letter of support. And then I had to make a decision, will I do this or won't I? And we have a little saying at the moment, it's, we're getting older, and you have to be realistic, and which is, well, if not now, when? So just get on with it and do it. So I'm going, and Tony will join me later on. But I'm doing a whole tour. So I'm going to Perth, and there's a therapist there who is going to see if there's anyone in the therapy world who'd like to do a day's training. And then I'm going to Brisbane. I'm going to work with KIFS, the Cult Information Family Service or something, and run a 2-day recovery workshop. And then I'll go to DCult, train therapists, and then do a 5-day workshop for therapists with lived experience. So it's going to be super busy.
Yeah, very. It's really wonderful, really wonderful. And you're right, there is the need to share this information, to pass this along. It's wonderful, too, that there are resources now out there in a way that there was not when we started doing this work. I mean, most of what I've learned has been from the clients themselves and from families who, when we were working together, just sort of doing a lot of trial and error, seeing what works better than other things and at different phases, and being open. I think it's important in a field that is growing and that's new and still developing to be open as the professional to feedback, because otherwise, you know, how do you grow and really be able to attend to the populations that you're working with? I know that when I was studying this in school, just studying psychology years ago, you know, when I heard that people in my program, when asked, and I've talked a little bit about this on the podcast before, when asked in my program what sort of things they would offer for their future clients as adjuncts to therapy, so many people mentioned groups that were cults, these large group awareness trainings or other organizations or some of these residential teen treatment places. I mean, it was just, and there at the time, there wasn't even a knowledge about the whole teen treatment issue like there is now, and how only some people have credentials who run some of these places. And so some are wholeheartedly abusive and unhealthy, while others might be fine, but you have to do your research. And so just knowing that someone's going to go to a therapist and the therapist is going to refer them to something that they might have to be rescued from, I thought, okay, I need to do this. I need to do this work, right? Similar to you, like, who is out here doing this and who cares and who has done some of this research, and that there's a great need. And so there's a great need for more people, I think, out there to do this work. Yeah, go ahead.
That's what kind of got you into the work, because I know you worked at the cult clinic because we met there. You remember?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
For about 2 hours, I was doing an investigation. I went to Wellspring in Meadowhaven and the cult clinic, and I proudly say that when I'm doing sort of explaining the roots of what I do is comes through all that I learned and clients. I mean, 100%, you know, without the clients, there's nothing, you don't learn anything. You know, you can read a book, but you know, so I hope that I've represented clients, and, you know, I'm open to people contacting me. Some people contact me and ask questions about the book, or, you know, always when I'm like you, I think always refining my thinking and just trying to take forward. It's a researcher sort of mindset of kind of, I'm learning, I need to listen, I'm learning from the next person. Because you know, people think, oh, you're an expert. I'm talking, you know, people say, well, you know, you're an expert. I think, well, I don't know you. I'm not an expert on you. I mean, I studied this subject, but you have to tell me about you and tell me if this applies to you or not.
Right. Yeah. And I've never called myself an expert. It's interesting. I'm sort of allergic to hubris. And
me maybe too. Other people do it, you know.
Yes, right. Right. And it doesn't mean you know everything. I think when people call you that, you just might know more than the next person because you care and you've done some of the research. I'm wondering then about, you know, Hope Valley. I'm wondering about getting it all started. That's a lot of work. It's a lot to do. And you've done some very big projects in your life that have taken time and a lot of effort. And so I'm just wondering about that you can inform people about. And also, as with anything, you know, there are some situations, some cases that I think always stay with us. Of course, without mentioning names or too many details, I'd love to hear about some of the cases that you've dealt with that have really spoken to your heart or who have really opened your eyes to something new or different. So tell me about the counseling center and about your experiences there so far.
So Hope Valley Counseling is not a center. I work from home, and of course we all had to do that, didn't we? But I did before. But I also worked for a rape crisis center, for a bereavement service, and for a sort of general mental health service here in the UK. And before I really moved into working just with former members, which is what I do now. And yeah, Hope Valley Counseling, it wouldn't exist without Tony's help, to be honest. Tony was a tax consultant when he worked. He's retired now. Retired in inverted commas because I keep him horribly busy, Paul. He loves watching cricket. He's a English bloke. And sometimes you have to prioritize this. Well, it's on, do it, go to it. So, but he has like the accounting and the sort of tax background that I don't have at all. I mean, okay, I've studied cults, but that is not my area, and nobody would want me to be doing that for them. Hope Valley Counseling's evolved. It's actually evolved, and everything that I do has evolved, and partly out of the Wellspring model of, see, at Wellspring, they gave everybody like psychoeducational sheets of paper with information on, or the summary of thought reform, and they could fill out how it affected them and whatever. So I thought that was a great idea. I thought about setting up a centre, which like hundreds of people have done. I mean, I'm not unusual in that. And Tony and I realised that, again, that's not my thing. That isn't my skill set, is to run a centre. The work is my skill set, the actual client work. And so gradually I started to realise there were lots of different areas of psychoeducational, psychological educational areas that would be useful for former members that I could build on from the Wellspring model. So I have a filing cabinet in my room, and I had about 30 subjects with sheets printed up, ready for the client if that subject came up. And then one day I had this massive aha moment where I thought, actually, the key things that we look at could go into a book, like just have it bound and have a workbook. And that was the recovery workbook, I called it. And I've used that for years with clients, and I've watched them really walk free and move on. And so then walking free was written on the basis of having used that workbook for years and having seen kind of what helped people. And not all of them helped everybody, but I tried to put in as much as I could into this journey on the roadmap, which we'll maybe come to. But so it's literally evolved. It's sort of an aha moment. And then actually, maybe there's a book here. And then how shall I write the book? Should the book be for therapists? Because therapists don't understand about cults, as we've said. They need educating. And then gradually, I thought, no, actually, it needs to be for former members with a chapter for therapists who could use it with them. And then that seems to, that worked. And so it's just been evolving. And I don't work all the time. I love watching crap on telly and walking my dog and, you know, living a life. I have a gorgeous daughters and, you know, so it's evolved.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Thank you. And yeah, I suppose I realized I was a lot more creative than I realized, you know, and that I wasn't as stupid as I thought I was. And that actually I had it in me. The roadmap in my book was really fun because what it did was it was quite a strange sensation of almost of having to take courage and dive in to creating it and actually putting it together into a cohesive sort of journey, and then explaining to this wonderful illustrator, Camilla Charnock, and sending her the weirdest roadmaps. I still got them, and, you know, it got transferred into something which I think's beautiful. I loved what she did with it, and she's got little birds in it and little things. So that was the sort of creative side and allowing somebody else or getting someone who can do it to actually help me.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that has been a challenge when I think about doing a webinar or doing anything where I'm teaching people how I do this or maybe teaching people to do this is taking something that I've never seen in black and white. I've never seen a curriculum. And I need to take it out of my head, right? And make it black and white. And then think about the steps. And I can imagine starting sort of in the middle and then saying, but actually, how did I get to that? Or how did I intuit that or know that? Okay, now let me go backwards. And I could see it going in so many different directions until I had something that looked like it made sense, because I think so much of what we do is from what we've learned, but also kind of an intuitive something. I don't even know the word for it. And I feel like even with the podcast, what I've come to learn is called the outro in podcast speak, the one more thing before you go, is this educational piece that was sort of my takeaway. Typically, when I would meet with a client, I'd hear their story, but then I'd think, okay, let me kind of zoom out in my own mind. What does this mean? What does this mean about what can happen to people? What does this mean about human nature? What does this mean about this person in a gestalt kind of way? Like, how do I make it make sense to me that this happened? Because you can, the story is important, but then you're in the weeds. And so how do you look at what that meant and what that means about all of us? Sort of how to generalize this message at maybe at different times in our life, et cetera. And so that this part has been sort of mirroring how I was after each session, sort of trying to think it through and how nice it was to go to a conference and to hear like Margaret Singer and other people put things into words. Oh, there's a term for that. Great, you know? And that was really lovely. That really helped along the way, but it's been a puzzle.
Yeah, and people like Margaret Singer, Janja Lalich, people on ahead, Maddie Tobias, who wrote a book with her, people who've moved forward before us, and a lot of the ICSA people. The Goldbergs and people you can sort of build on and build on and creatively expand and bring one's own, like your take on it. And it's very interesting, very interesting.
And I think also knowing that the style that you use when you're working with someone also can be very healing, because you're open to learning, you're open to having it be an almost like a, I want to say an equal relationship. Like I can offer what I know to you and what I've learned, and it helps for me to get feedback from you. And it isn't hierarchical in that same way, you know, which I've really enjoyed.
And I think that's really important, particularly with people who've been in these highly controlling. It was certainly important for me. And I had a lot of years of therapy with the sweetest, most wonderful therapist. She was a Gestalt therapist, which is why I chose her. But she had a very gentle style. Some Gestalt therapists can be quite harsh. So, you know, one has to choose one's therapist carefully. But she didn't really know about cults, but I'd understood that piece. So then I could work on the trauma and that sort of thing. Therapy was one of the best things I ever did, having the right therapist. And she was the right therapist for me. I mean, it's made a whole difference to my life in many ways. For me, you know, I just work in my way. And if people don't want to work in the way I work, obviously they'll go and see somebody else. So I think the joy of it is watching somebody really make sense of what happened and begin to heal and to see actually the shame doesn't belong to me. And I just did a midterm review with someone, and she was very broken when she came to me 10 years out, and it was just still a struggle. And just seeing actually this is making a difference, isn't that just a joy? Like, why would you do it if it didn't make a difference? So that in a general sense, and again, realistically, you can't help everybody, but for the people it really works for, it really works. And I think the people, do you know, it's often younger people, although not always, but just that imprint of just the bafflement of having been taken so off course. They were on a road and they ended up somewhere completely different. And they're like, oh, how did I get here? Nobody knows I got here. Like, I haven't told anyone. And just beginning to help them to, again, just undo the shame of it, perhaps start to reconnect with their family more. And then for those who've been shunned, I think that's probably the most breaking, isn't it? Like those I've worked with who have nobody, no family who want anything to do with them is heartbreaking. And very courageous of them to leave and to know that they're going to lose so much, but that actually for them to become themselves truly, authentically, autonomously themselves, they need to do that. I think everyone leaves a mark in some way, imprints something on you. And I do it because I love to do it. And I'd do it if I won the lottery. So I'll just keep doing it till I think actually maybe you need to hang up your boots.
I think each client leaves an imprint on you, and you might leave an imprint on them. And what I've noticed, and I don't know if you've had this experience, is that sometimes you can say something that feels so wise and you're thinking, oh, that's, wow, that's not bad. You know, maybe I'll write that down. That's a good little nugget. And then the next week, let's say a client comes in or comes back on Zoom, and they say, something you said last week really stayed with me. And you're sure that it's the thing, right? And that, you know, you're so proud of. And they will say, you know, when you were just leaning down and asking if your dog was okay. And I thought, what?
Yeah.
and they said, you know, just I realize that I've never been around that, you know, or people who care about someone else's or something else's feelings. And I missed that. And I thought, I wish someone could ask me sometimes, are you okay? And I thought, oh, but you just don't know what it is. And so I think just the process of talking or just being yourself, or, you know, people sometimes if they sneeze or they cough and you say, are you okay? That in that moment, they might get this sense, wow, I haven't actually had someone care about me or ask me if I'm okay for a very long time. And I'm now feeling how long it's been and what that feels like. And it could just be just an offhand something.
Yeah.
But just the humanity, I think just a show of humanity. And then you realize what these individuals have gone without for so long because they've been involved in something that has the sense of importance and they're driven and pushed, but they're not treated kindly. Like with your therapist, that what stays with you about your time with your therapist was the loveliness of it, along with other things. But it just showed what you needed and maybe what you hadn't been treated with for so long.
Yes, exactly. And yes, really fine-tuned care. And, you know, you're upset. Like, do you need me to give you a hug? Because we'd set it up that we were happy. I was happy for that. So with some people, you set up, I don't want you to touch me, and that's fine. I didn't need that at this stage. I probably would have earlier on. And so very fine-tuned sensitivity and empathy, which was very lovely.
Yeah. Well, so I'm wondering also, you know, because you've mentioned this now, and it is a very important thing to discuss, just about the shame and carrying shame and what helps with that and what sort of understanding why that happens, why, I mean, some people are more comfortable with the word victim than others, but I'll use it here without meaning to be insensitive.
Yeah, I mean, I was a victim of abuse. It doesn't mean I have a victim mentality. It means
abused. Yeah. So then to use that word here, that it's often the victims of a lot of things that are the ones carrying the shame. No, they didn't do it to themselves, but somehow they think they did or are told that they did. And so to understand that psychologically and then what has helped people move beyond that, sort of what helped you and how you help others free themselves of that. I mean, because if the person who did this to them had the interest or the ability to feel that kind of humility, take responsibility, have insight and apologize and mean it, great. That would make it a lot clearer, but that doesn't happen. So it seems then by default, it goes to the others and society also blames the victim. So I'm curious if we can get into that, how that happens, it gets so embedded and what helps release it.
Well, it's a natural human emotion anyway. We have a tendency. So children, say, who are abandoned or abused will tend to think it's their fault and feel shame about it, whereas actually it's not their fault. It's nothing. A child can't do that to themselves. It's actually the adult's shame or the abuser's shame. It's there in us. But I think, so in Lifton's thought reform system, as you know, within the demand for purity, the demand for always being pure, perfect, obeying, doing exactly what you're told, living up to the doctrine, jumping to every command, the black and white thinking, it actually creates shame and guilt. And then it results in a kind of a confession of that sin, using Christian language, but other situations have their own language. So I think it then becomes a perpetuating issue, shame. And I think it's really important to understand the cult actually exacerbates or makes much bigger a natural human. They're all natural human emotions, of course they are. But there's cult-induced guilt and there's cult-induced shame. And it's never a good thing. So my understanding is really, or my way of looking at it, is really helping people to understand the system of thought reform, actually, within a cult, and to see that, and I explicitly address guilt and shame within those, that section, and it's in Walking Free, in that part of the book, so that, you know, just sort of gradually, slowly but surely helping someone to see, actually, maybe this wasn't about me. This was a big conversation I had to have endlessly with my therapist, which was, just because they say it about you doesn't mean it's necessarily true. And gosh, that took a lot of getting out of my head. I think even 7 years did a job on that, that they're right, because they must be right. Or if two or three people say it, they must be right, but they might not be right. And that was a big learning curve then. I think that was a shame-based kind of response of, yes, of course, it must be true. Of course, I must be whatever they're saying. And I've got much more resilient now, I hope. And I have support if it gets me.
Mm-hmm. Having confirmation by other people really makes it harder when you have like people who... or former Jehovah's Witnesses who will talk about having to go in front of this council of men who are all saying something to you about what you've done wrong. It's still, no matter how many people are talking to you, it doesn't mean they're right. I mean, I think about a Ku Klux Klan rally, right? They're all saying something and they're all agreeing. And from my sense of it, none of them are right. And so it could be thousands of people all at once saying something, and it doesn't mean they're right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, we always have to think about it. But in a cultic kind of setting, that's the sort of peer pressure and the kind of tidal wave. I mean, Lifton says that milieu control is the psychological current on which all else in the thought reform system depends. And that, to me, that sort of, you know, the micromanaging of your life, the cutting off of communication outside of that group and then cutting off communication within yourself, it does a job on you. And then, you know, you're in it. You're in what one of my participants called a marble edifice. You know, you're just in there and captured in it. And then the rest of the thought reform can start to really do its job. Well, the system of the cult, although I understand system is loaded language in some cults, so I do apologize. It's very hard to get the language. Language is tricky.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wonder also if what helps with abandoning some of the shame is the building of confidence or the rebuilding of confidence. You know, it's an interesting balance. Where if you start to think of yourself as being of value or deserving of being treated a certain way, that helps you potentially move away from the shame, maybe even to some anger, right?
Yeah, healthy anger. So in Walking Free, there's a whole chapter on anger, assertive anger, and how it's utterly essential for us to push back and to have boundaries and things. And the other thing, there's a chapter in Walking Free on healthy self-love, and I looked at Craig Malkin's Rethinking Narcissism, and he puts narcissism, and it's a tricky word because we're all going, oh, they're a narcissist, everybody's a narcissist. And I told myself the other day, I've got to stop talking about but you know, that he talks about it on a continuum, and that in the middle of the continuum is healthy narcissism, a sort of healthy confidence, a place where, like, we can do this. We can step up and do a podcast or something which needs to pull on confidence within us. But then we can let that drop off. When we're not needing to pull on it, it can lower down the scale. Whereas somebody like the cult leaders, they're traumatizing narcissists who don't, that it's not flexible. They're not moving down to actually, I don't have any investment in being, you know, something special at this point. They need to be in that place. I quite like that. I don't know if it works for everybody, but, you know, that there's different types, that we need that confidence, but it doesn't mean we have to be traumatizing others.
Right. You know, so much has to do with the nature of the person who has started these groups and what the power of it does to them. You know, I think about a time that it was my first, what was it, national television interview. And it was, I mean, that's very heady, especially first time. And I was young. And somebody said to me, oh, so, you know, were you sort of flying high after and thinking, oh, you know, I've reached the top? And I thought, no, I cleaned the guinea pig cage and made dinner for my kids. Like, well, it was a Tuesday. Okay. You know, moving on. I mean, it was fun. And it took me a while to get all the makeup, the sprayed makeup off. That was probably a bigger ordeal. That took me as long as cleaning the guinea pig cage. But, you know, it depends on your personality of origin, I think, right? And when you talk about, when you said that the group that you were in, that people were lovely, I've heard it so often where people will talk about they miss the people there and that they were good and they had good intentions. And I often think if the leader could just pull away from the organization, it could be great. It has the potential to really be healthy, but not with someone in charge who's not.
Exactly. And who's controlling. Exactly. And then that's a challenge to anybody in our field who wants to lead others. And it's a challenge to me as well. And with the, you know, training people on the certificate, I tend to mentor them because it's a very particular model of counselling. It's not the usual. It's based on the usual model of counselling, the walking free model, as I'm calling it now, that actually I'll mentor them and supervise them maybe for a year or two, and then they go, it let go, and they do peer supervision now. And so it's kind of helping them to get used to the model because I created it, but then to let go and to say, okay, you need somebody else who understands the model, because if you go to any other therapist, they won't know what you're talking about, but do peer supervision and trying to really listen to my own theory and hold lightly and let go. And I have people in my life who I said to, if I start getting a bit above myself, then you have full permission to tell me, you know, but it's necessary because anybody could just get above themselves or think they're the best or the specialist.
Right. I like that, the hold lightly. I mean, that I gave a talk years ago about healthy therapy versus not. And so one of the signs when the is when a therapist needs to be needed. And that if you say, I think I'm ready to do some, you know, sort of be on my own, try out what we've gone over and see if I'm okay. And then the therapist or coach or whomever suddenly says, but you have all these things that are wrong with you that you need to work on. Some of which they may have mentioned before, some of which they may have been throwing at you in that moment, that they're worried about you pulling away from them. And that has happened. And that certainly when people will say, I think I'm ready, or even leaving a cultic group, no, you know, because you have all these problems and you have all these needs, and or you're going to do all this damage to people, like what was told to you, which is a huge, you know, manipulative control tactic, which is so cruel to do to people. And so I think the fact that you have a light touch with people and you let them see that they can have a sense of, I guess, real agency over what they do and when and the decisions they make.
I mean, and that's with the trainees and, clients. I mean, we're taught, certainly in the UK, that you're always aiming toward the ending. And, you know, sometimes we work for a lot of time. It might be years with some people for various reasons, but there's always the opportunity to end. And I try and, you know, reflect back. Are you happy with what we're doing? Is there anything you want to change? You know, yeah. So there's an ending in sight, and that, and reassuring them this isn't a rejection. I'm not saying I'm trying to get rid of you. I'm just saying you're free to go, you know, and I won't be here forever. None of us will. So it's not going to work. We can't hold on to people forever, you know, practicalities as well. But yeah, it's just healthy, good therapy to be aware of the ending. And if somebody isn't letting you go, leave them now. They're not doing what they should do.
Right. Okay. So I know we're about done with time, and I want people to be able to find your book, your, you know, you basically. And if they want to confer with you or get counseling from you, where can they find you?
So I have a website, which is hopevalleycounseling.com. We spell counseling with two L's in the UK, but I think it would find me anyway. And on my website are also my affiliates, who are some of the therapists that I trained. So I'm going to be away in Australia and New Zealand, as I said earlier. So people can contact them. They're all trained. They're wonderful. They all have lived experience. So they're really fabulous people. I wouldn't have them on my site if I didn't think so. So I can be found there. My book, Walking Free from the Trauma of Coercive, Cultic and Spiritual Abuse, a workbook for recovery and growth, is available from Routledge, which is the publisher, or Amazon, or in a good bookstore. They can order it for you, or, you know, you can maybe, if you're lucky, find it over the counter. So yeah, that's me basically. And people get in touch with any of us through email is the best way, and we take it from there.
Lovely. It's so nice to speak with you. I hope we get to see each other again in person and enjoy catching up and enjoy a laugh. It's really, you're a lovely, lovely person, and I look forward to people reading your book, getting really very tangible help with it, because I love how applicable it is and how immediately useful it is.
That means a lot to me coming from you. So thanks.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Great to see you. Great to talk to you. Hope to do it again soon. One more thing before you go. It is always so, so, so nice to talk to Jilly. I hope to be able to see her again in person one of these days. I've missed seeing her at conferences, and she's a total delight and very smart. And I like how open she was today with all of us in talking about what a struggle this all is, not only during, but after. You know, I get asked the question a lot, how long is this going to take? When people come to me for therapy, or people's spouses, parents, children contact me and say, I really want my loved one to meet with you and get some help and get past their experience if they can, how long is it going to take? It's a very hard question to answer. And it's an interesting thing because it kind of puts me into this interesting mindset where I think that's actually why, to a certain degree, cults, a lot of self-help groups, others are going to be successful If they make you a promise that within a certain amount of time, you will achieve whatever it is that you want to achieve, you will have total happiness in our 12-week program, or you will find your fortune after these 5 seminars. And it's not honest. It's not fair. And I think when those promises are made, then they have a built-in out for the people making the promise that if you don't find your fortune after these 5 workshops, seminars, well, then you just weren't ready for it, or you weren't paying attention, or maybe you need a refresher and we have another seminar for that. Or if you are not having your true happiness, well, maybe there's some blockage getting in the way of that. And so let me help you with that. We happen to have a group for that, a class for that, a fake medicine for that. But I also do still understand the question. And when you hear someone like Jilly saying that she was stuck in the cult mindset for 14 years after, I'm not surprised. Sometimes even after getting help, you can still find yourself stuck in a cult mindset. And it might mean that you need some more help or you need a different kind of help. But either way, when people do ask me that question, I've felt that I've needed to come up with some kind of answer, because I think what they're asking is, I don't want to feel, or I don't want my loved one to feel this forever. So when do we start to feel relief, or when do we start to see that our loved one is feeling some relief and getting back to who they were, or learning how to be in the world without that programming? And so what I tell people is to give it at least a year, to go through the yearly cycle of things that you were supposed to feel differently about when you were in the cult: holidays, birthdays, anniversaries. None of these things matter when you're involved in a cult, typically. And so suddenly you're faced with having a birthday, and what do you do for it? Or if you were involved in a group where it was considered pagan to celebrate a holiday. I've been at former Jehovah's Witnesses' first Christmas in their 40s, 50s, 60s. And still they're kind of ducking, expecting that God is going to punish them. And they have to kind of get through the first celebration, the first anniversary. The first anniversary also of something that's difficult, a loss that they incurred while they were in the group, a funeral that happened that they couldn't go to, and now it's the year anniversary of it. And so I think it's important to go through the firsts with support and with someone to lean on and to help you through those firsts, and with a family, hopefully if you have a connection still to family, or with loved ones who can help guide you back into the world, enjoying the celebrations and the difficult moments for the first time or the first time again. And then, after that, there's usually more to do, more to talk about. But I let people know that there are always going to be things that were left unfinished because you might not have realized they were issues at the time, and things that got under your skin, and things that were going to pop up at some future date. Like, I've worked with a number of people who said, you know what, I feel like I'm ready to be out on my own and do my thing. And I say, yes, of course, go for it. You know where to reach me if you need to come back. But I wish you well. And then suddenly, they incur a loss, and they don't know what to do because they have not been guided or have forgotten how to deal with sadness and loss. They don't have an immediate answer for it. And so they're not sure what to do with all the emotions that are coming up and all the questions that are coming up. Or they're going on a date for the first time suddenly feeling panicked. What if they get asked about where they've been over the last few years or their whole life? And if they've been taught about themselves that they can't trust themselves and they can't trust their own opinions of things and their own instincts, which happens a lot in cults, how do they know if they want to go on a second date with someone? How do they know if that person is safe? How do they know that they can trust a person who they're opening up to because the last person they trusted abused that trust? And these are the moments where people will call me back and sometimes feel bad saying that, you know, they feel like they've regressed, but they haven't regressed. They just realized that this was another hurdle. And life sometimes informs us about our hurdles. And it's good to know that it doesn't mean you're going backwards. It means you need a little bit of support to keep going forward. Talk to you next week. Take care. Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.